Hi, everyone. My name is Kirk Bachman, and welcome back to The Ultimate Dish. Today is a very special day at The Ultimate Dish. We officially made it to 100 episodes. To celebrate this monumental milestone, our guest on the show today is the incredible Michel Escoffier, the great-grandson of our school's namesake, Auguste Escoffier, otherwise known as the King of Chefs and the father of modern French cuisine. As the president of the Auguste Escoffier Foundation and Museum in Villeneuve-Loubet, France, an advisory board member of Auguste Escoffier School of Culinary Arts, Michel strives to remain highly involved in preserving his great-grandfather's long-lasting memory. Michel and his father also published Souvenirs en Danie, Auguste Escoffier, later translated by his wife under the title Auguste Escoffier, Memories of My Life, in 1996. These pages artfully illustrate Escoffier's distinct food philosophy, describing dishes, presentations, and original recipes. Today, Michel continues to participate in events around the globe to form partnerships with organizations that bear the famous Escoffier name. So join me today as we speak with Michel about keeping his great-grandfather's legacy alive and his future vision for culinary arts. Good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm saying good morning to you, but you should say good evening.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Because right now it's 5 p.m. and beautiful blue sky. So we're enjoying every minute of it.
I love it. In the south of France, we're so honored. And I feel so blessed. I've gotten to speak with you quite a bit of late and saw you recently in the beautiful state of Texas. When we kicked this off, I mentioned Memories of My Life and what a beautiful memoir that is. This is my copy, and I want to just share what you wrote to me in 2014. To Kirk, enjoy sharing a full and exciting life through the world's major social changes. Such foresight right off the bat. And the other thing I wanted to mention, when I open this book, Michel, and I see that it's translated by Laurence. Yeah. And the foreword was written by Ferdinand Metz, who we both know.
Absolutely, a very good friend.
Yes. The preface was by Pierre, and the introduction by Julia Child. I don't know how you get a more stellar starting lineup for a beautiful book like that, right?
Well, they both Ferdinand and in his own capacity as the president of the CIA for many years, and then Julia, who was also a friend of the family, she knew my parents quite well because she used to come every summer to the south of France and visit a friend, the one that she wrote a couple of books with. And so they were seeing each other. It was a whole community of English-speaking people because my parents were basically based in London as well.
Sure.
My dad, actually, I like to say that my dad was in oil, but he wasn't in cooking oil. He was a director of Shell Petroleum.
Yes.
So anyway, Julia was a great friend. I met her on several occasions. And one of them was actually the last time I saw her. We drove down with Mary Cameron, my great friend from Carmel, who is the president of Les Dames d'Escoffier and the Disciples of Escoffier for the West Coast. And her dear husband was still alive then. We drove down to Santa Barbara, where Julia was staying, to have just lunch with her. And she was so thrilled to see us again. And that was in July, and she passed away in August that year. So we were quite happy to have done that.
Incredible memories. So before we dive into so many questions that I have, can you set the stage a little bit? I see a lot of sunlight coming in. It's later in the afternoon. You don't have to turn the camera, but set the stage. When you look off your balcony, what are we looking at?
I'm looking at Saint-Paul-de-Vence, which is a very famous little village on a hill. It's a fortified village with a big wall around it. And of course, it's the place that is visited by many, many tourists, along with other places. And then I have right below me, this is the village where my great-grandfather was born and where we have in his birthplace, the museum, Escoffier Museum of Culinary Art. So I don't have to, it's only a 3-minute drive down to the museum, which is good.
Or a 7-minute walk, right?
Well, maybe a little more, especially coming back, because I'm on a hill, so going back is quite steep.
We're absolutely going to dive into our school's legacy that bears your name. But let's talk a little bit about you first, Michelle. You were born in Paris. You attended university in Switzerland and then became an executive and a consultant in urban development and in telecommunications. Can you share how your extensive travels over the years ignited this longing to learn more about your great-grandfather?
Yes. Well, I did travel a lot, and particularly in the years where I was promoting the concept of the facts system to faraway countries, flying for 10 or 12 hours to Thailand or Australia or Japan. And I was often asked in the hotels where I was staying by the general manager whether I was related to the famous chef. So this sort of started to trigger an interest. How come that so many faraway countries knew about, you know, my great-grandfather when he hadn't even set foot in them? He was very well known in Britain and the United States. I remember my grandmother saying that when she was going in New York, where she had a business to buy things at Bloomingdale's for her grandchildren or something. At the time, you didn't use a credit card. You used checks. So she was signing a check, and the girl at the counter would say, "Oh, it's coffee. Are you related to the chef?" So this is when I started being really interested in what my great-grandfather did. And I understood that the reason why he was so well-known around the world is because he left behind the famous Guide Culinaire, which is still the name, the Bible of every chef. Because he left also behind working techniques in the kitchen and behavioral standards. And this is why he's known worldwide, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope it's appropriate to ask, do you share the same passion for cooking? Does it run in the blood, in the DNA?
Well, let's put it another way. One day, an American journalist asked me many years ago, I had just spoken to some students, and he came up and said, "By the way, do you cook?" And I said, "Well, it came right away." I said, "Of course I do, but only confidentially with friends." I'm not cooking, you know, officially for anybody. I don't want to be judged, but I like to cook, especially with this group of friends. And I hope that next time I visit Boulder, we'll have a little session with a few of your teachers and we can do a dinner together. The one thing that I'm proud of doing, which is my specialty, is scrambled eggs.
Okay.
And I believe that it may come from my great-grandfather, because he doesn't actually explain in the Guide Culinaire how he does scrambled eggs, but he used to do them for a great friend of his, Sarah Bernhardt, the famous actress, when she was visiting the Savoy or Lake of the Carlton. And one day she said to a journalist who asked her what was the reason for her good health and her energy, and she answered, "Well, probably the fact that I always have a glass of champagne with Mr. Iskoftis scrambled eggs for breakfast."
Not a bad way to start the day, right?
Right.
So you've spoken of how you became aware and others made you aware. Was your great-grandfather's legacy in any way woven into your childhood? Did it influence your parents as they navigated and cooked in the kitchen?
No, not really, but I can explain. First of all, Auguste was associated for many years with Ritz, and together they established the basis of the modern luxury hotels, and those spaces are still in practice today. And so he never had his own business, except for a short while, but at the beginning of his career. And then he moved back to Paris when he married. And from then on, he really was involved in enlarged the organization and management of large kitchens. So first of all, it wasn't a family business. Secondly, I think that probably you have to have big guts to step into someone's shoes like that, you know, because I always thought if I'm successful, people will say, "Yeah, but he's been helped by his background or whatever." And if you're not successful, it's even worse, and say, "Oh, the poor, poor kid, you know, he doesn't stand up to his great-grandfather. So in any case, I was attracted by many other things and traveling around, which incidentally chefs do as well. I see many chefs go from one country to another, as long as they learn languages properly. So that's probably the reason why. My grandfather did manage hotels at some point. He also managed a company that before the First World War was making sauces in Britain. It was a British family, and they were making the sauces made from Auguste Escoffier's recipes. So he managed that. And then during the First World War, he was commissioned by the British government to actually organize the supply, all the supplies for the British Legion based in Boulogne in France. And for that, he actually received the Order of the British Empire, which I think is quite an achievement.
Absolutely.
But then, as I said, my father was also involved with the British company, but not in cooking. And so when we were going to a restaurant in England, of course, when you reserve, you give your name and people come up because it's a restaurant and they say, we'd like to know if you're related to the chef. So this is the way that we knew that my great-grandfather had made an imprint in his field. But it's only when I started traveling in faraway countries that I realized how important he was for the profession.
Yeah, along those lines, Michel, and you've said in an interview that I read recently, and I quote, you said the name Escoffier means something. It means we remain committed to the level of quality that he has always fought for. So with that in mind, what steps did you take at that point in your life to start to grow and reinvigorate Auguste's legacy?
Well, when I got closer to ending my career with Alcatel, and I started thinking about what could I do with the many years that are still in front of me, which has to do with the job that my great-grandfather did. And of course, at the time, the foundation, which I now preside, existed, but I wasn't even really directly involved in it. So I started by becoming a member of the board of directors. And I was going to New York quite often because part of my wife's family is in New York. And I was also a member of Les Amis d'Escoffier Society, which incidentally had been started by Joseph Donon in 1936, a year after Escoffier's death. And Donon was actually the man behind the creation of the foundation and the museum, because thanks to Escoffier, who had met him when he visited the family, and he visited the marquis who owned the castle on top of the hill for lunch, he went to the kitchen and congratulated the young chef, was by then 18. years old, and offered him to come and work with him at the Carlton in London. So, of course, Donon arrived a week later and for 6 years went through all the stages of learning the trade and all this. And then in 1912, I like to tell this anecdote because it shows what fate does well sometimes. Mr. and Mrs. Frick were visiting the Carlton Hotel. Frick was a famous industrialist who left actually the Frick Collection in New York, famous museum. And they wanted to bring a chef back because in those days you didn't invite people in the restaurants, or you invited them home in your mansions, things like
sure.
that. So, of course, having many people at your service and a French chef was even better. So Donon had served them for a few times. And so Escoffier asked him, would you like to work for a private? So anyway, the deal was done and they were quite excited because they were going to sail back to the United States on board the Titanic, except that Mrs. Frick fell in the stairs of the Carlton 2 days before departure. And the husband said, oh, let's not bother. We're going to take another ship a week later. Wow. So that's how take me back to the United States. And then, not to make it too long, Donon actually had to go back to France in 1914 to fight in the war. they came back because he had just married a young woman from Boston. So he found his wife when he went back, and they moved. He moved to the service of the Vanderbilt family and then stayed until he retired to the service of the Vanderbilt family. And this is when, in 1936, he created in New York the famous Les Amis de Scottish Society, which actually gave birth to a slight variation of it, which started in Nice with a friend of his in Nice, south of France, which was called the Disciples of Escoffier, which now is a quite large association of chefs and gastronomes, probably slightly over 10,000 members now, called Disciples Escoffier International. So this is really the background and why, thanks to fate, as I said, we had Donneau alive and well in the United States. And he was able to be at the start of all this, the foundation and the museum. And he even set up a trust fund to finance the running and the upkeep of the museum, which was pretty good for many years.
I love the stories, and thankful for fate indeed. So to fast forward just a little bit, if we could and may spend all day talking about your great-grandfather and how he transformed the culinary world. In fact, the mission statement of our school here at Escoffier, the teachings and the core curriculum rooted in modern French cuisine is really modeled after Escoffier's methodologies, and we're really proud of that. One of the most extraordinary accomplishments that he achieved, and I'd love to talk to Michel about how he gave back and how social issues at the time were really important to Auguste, but he developed an entirely new system in which he organized the kitchen and menu development and training, but this organization was really spectacular. And I'm sure you have an elevator speech, but if we kind of move to History 101 on Escoffier, could you speak a little bit about his approach to kitchen organization and why that was so important and still is today?
Yes. Well, first of all, when he left school at the age of 13, he had to learn a trade, and his father sent him to his uncle in Nice, who was running a restaurant called the Restaurant Français. So he started in the kitchen at the age of 13. And in those days, of course, the working conditions were pretty appalling. You were, you know, using coal. There was no air conditioning. So apparently, when cooks were thirsty, they were drinking alcohol. They were allowed to smoke. I mean, all sorts of things, which when Escoffier wrote in his memoirs that since he had to become a cook, which wasn't his first choice, he wanted to be a sculptor, but his father said, sculpture will get you nowhere. You better learn a real trade. So, which I think he was right to do. So I'm going to try and be the best at it, he said, but also spent all his life and effort to improve the working conditions in the kitchens and improve not only for the sake of his employees, but also for being more efficient. And so, first of all, he banned smoking and drinking alcohol in the kitchen. He had a nutritionist friend who came up with a drink, which was probably a kind of mixture of lemon and barley with ice, and so they could drink as much as they wanted of that. That incidentally is the kind of drink that we were drinking after a game of tennis in London, lemon barley drink. So that was he didn't want people to shout in the kitchen. So, of course, as I said before, when they were drinking alcohol, well, arguments at the end of the day could be dealt with knives that were hanging around, you know, and all this. So he didn't want any of this. No shouting, even if you called the dish that was the order of a patron and all this, you could announce it. It wasn't barking it, but announcing it. When he was getting annoyed at something, he was known for leaving the kitchen for a few minutes and then coming back and explaining calmly what was not right. The next thing, of course, he was confronted with serving many people, up to 500 or 600 people, quickly and warm. So this is when he came up with the system you mentioned, which he actually called the brigade system with the chef de partie. he probably got inspired by his years during the Franco-Prussian War, because the word brigade is actually pretty much a military thing. But although it was, he wasn't running the kitchen as a general, yeah, I suppose he wanted everyone to be efficient in the task he was doing. And by having chef de partie in charge of every part of a dish, the dish was actually made much faster. Before, it was the same chef who would do the vegetables on one side, the sauce on the other, cooking the meat and all this. With his system, everyone was doing something which ended up with the final product, which makes me say sometimes that he was a tailorist before Taylor. The only thing is he didn't have the conveyor belt in the kitchen.
And we still practice and preach those processes today. You know, on a similar note, Escoffier himself said, cooking like fashion must evolve with time and absolutely take into account the changes in people's lives. So profound, right?
Yes, he adds in the book of menus that therefore we will have to offer lighter dishes and shorter menus.
Yeah.
And then he adds that cooking, whilst remaining an art, will become more scientific. We will have to give up our theories, which are still too empirical, to leave nothing to chance. But then I always, when I say this to students, I always finish by saying, but he also says, what will not change are the basic principles of cooking, the fundamentals. And I added once, and I think students understood what I meant. I said, it's like music. You all love music, I'm sure. If you have the fundamentals, you can play Bach, Chopin, jazz, or even create, you know, improvise. But if you don't have the bass, then you will only make noise. Yeah. And when I say the word noise, they laugh. Say, yeah, you can always tap on the piano, but you're not going to make any music.
Michel, how do you believe or think that cooking has evolved since your great-grandfather's time? And what does the landscape of cooking look like today to you?
We've seen, changes. As you mentioned before, Escoffier himself says, there is absolutely no reason why an art that has to evolve like fashion, it has to adapt to modern times. And he could see, although when he writes this, there were hardly any cars on the road, he sees that people need to spend less time to eat. And I'm sure today, if he, I insist in saying this, because people very often, they use the word fast food for describing mediocre food. And I don't agree with that. You see, I think this Escoffier would very much be in fast food, because the principle he had was that whatever you do, you have to start with the quality of the product, absolutely mm-hmm. impeccable quality of the product. Then you have to add to this an impeccable technique, is something which is not, you know, improvised, and all this has to be perfectly executed. And therefore, you can apply this to fast food. And it's ridiculous to say that because it's fast food, it shouldn't be palatable. So that's one thing. The other thing which we heard about my father in his time was often asked, what do you think of nouvelle cuisine? And he said, well, there is no such thing as nouvelle cuisine, because every generation comes up with something which is an evolution of what was done before. And the best thing was when I was asked, and what would your great-grandfather think of fusion cuisine? And I had just spoken about the fact that he was so modern and in advance for his time. And he said, well, I'm sure it would be fusion cuisine as long as it doesn't become confusion.
You know, along those same lines, Michel, we know that we've read that Escoffier was very proud of the fact that he had taught over 2,000 chefs who then went on to train other chefs, and all the while promoting classic French cuisine and techniques and a way to conduct yourself in the kitchen. If Auguste were here today and he could witness the school that we've all built in his honor, what do you think he would say?
He would applaud with four hands if he could. He would be absolutely thrilled. I'd like to remind you that not only did he form over 2,000 chefs who in their turn went around the world to cook, you know, French cuisine and using French products. He was also very proud of, you know, quality of French products whenever they could be promoted. But he was also among those who created the pretty much the first real culinary school in London in 1911, the Westminster Kingsway College, which is still one of the very top schools in Britain. So it's obvious that he wasn't just content with being a great chef and making people happy and creating new dishes for famous people. And of course, he was smart enough. He was a marketing man before the word even existed, because along with Brits, they understood that the first thing they had to do was the lighting and light fixtures in the restaurant should enhance the jewelry and the dresses and the complexion of ladies. Because, of course, by pleasing the ladies, he was actually pleasing the men that were paying the bill. So that was already something. And so the lighting and everything. He also named most of these dishes, many of his dishes, after many famous people, but many, many of them were women, well-known actresses and singers, opera singers like Nellie Melba, etc. And so he would certainly be absolutely thrilled to see that today he's alive and well, and lives in Texas and lives in Austin and in Boulder, Colorado, and in Chicago, where we have the baseball for the online system. He would be absolutely thrilled about this.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Michel. And we call that the Escoffier difference. As long as we're talking about that, we've mentioned at the beginning that you serve as the president of Auguste Escoffier Foundation, and an organization founded to perpetuate the memory and accomplishments of its namesake, Auguste. And so you're a distinguished member of our school's advisory board. You, as you mentioned, you're on our campuses a lot. You participate in the board meetings and other meetings. I'm curious in your opinion, from what you've seen, and you've been associated with many in this industry for many years, what sets Auguste Escoffier School of Culinary Arts apart from other institutions?
Well, the first thing that I could mention is the fact that when we started with two schools, the one in Boulder in particular, there was already included in the curriculum the farm-to-table program. Mm-hmm. That was already quite outstanding and an innovation. It was unique at the time. Then, of course, the other thing which makes our schools outstanding is the introduction of the online program. And then the other thing, of course, is that it gives our students a professional qualification at an affordable cost. Often the fact that the cost is often a break for, you know, hindering the possibility for students to learn a trade. So providing a professional qualification at an affordable cost is certainly something, another thing that would please my great-grandfather enormously. Because he, as you know, we may say a few words about it, he was also a great humanitarian. And although he was serving the rich and powerful, he was always concerned with the poverty and hunger. And he even came up with an essay on the extinction of pauperism, where he gives solutions for avoiding, you know, like his own old chefs retiring. If they didn't have a family or a place to go, they hardly had anything. They didn't have a retirement home. They didn't have anything. So he fought for that. He hated waste. And therefore, when he got to the Savoy Hotel with Ritz in 1890, he immediately started a system with the Little Sisters of the Poor, where he was providing food that hadn't been served the day before and couldn't be served anymore at the hotel, but was perfectly all right for the poor, including, he tells the story about the quails, because in those days you were only serving the wings of the quails and therefore reserving the legs, and had come up with a recipe that was quail with rice pilaf rice. So anyway, there are many other examples. He was the first to think of fundraising dinners and the money would be used for improving the retirement home that had been built in the south of France, in the south of Paris, I mean. So he thought of the Dîner d'Epicure, which we reinitiated the foundation for the 150th anniversary of his birth in 1996. And these are very successful. When he did them in 1912, can you imagine that it involved on the same evening with the same menu, 37 cities in Europe and 4,000 guests, 4,000 patrons. So imagine hardly the telephone or the telegraph, how they were able to organize themselves to come up with a scheme like that was quite amazing.
So amazing and so ahead of his time, as you mentioned, Michel. And I think about, you commented on food waste or waste not, 100 years ahead of its time, because obviously that is at the forefront of everything that we think about today. I wanted to mention, too, that it's really important for us to spend a little bit of time talking about the museum, which opened in 1966, right there in the south of France, to pay homage to Escoffier. To give our listeners and our viewers just a little visual of the museum, about 10 rooms form the backdrop to Escoffier's memories with items and utensils of the time. I've been there a couple of times. There's a wealth of documents on culinary art. There are dress tables, a Provençal kitchen, an extensive collection of menus, both ancient and modern, items made of sugar, chocolate, as well as a beautiful library. And there's a little courtyard now with a bus. How do you manage it?
Can we hire you? We've got many English-speaking visitors.
I'm in.
You're doing such a good job that I'm going to add to this. It's well done. Thanks, Dirk.
Yes, we will push this out on social media.
This is music to my ears.
but truly, it's a lot to manage because there's a standard, right? There's a standard that you have to keep this at to honor your great-grandfather.
You forgot just one little thing to mention, is that during the summer, from the 1st of June to the end of September, we're offering a taste of peach melba to every visitor on presentation of their entrance ticket. And they can actually, you mentioned the little courtyard, they can have it. We have tables and chairs. So at the end of a visit, where you have a full room filled with exhibitions made by pastry chefs of made of sugar and chocolate, and it smells. It's a museum where you can smell things, and then you can even taste things during the summer. Yeah. You can taste the peach melba, which of course is the most famous dessert that he created. But I'm happy that you mentioned that, because we are actually now I have a new team since the 2016. I'm surrounded by a curator who is absolutely fabulous, very active. He was a former hotel director. He managed the Martinez Hotel in Cannes for many years, but many other hotels as well. I have a treasurer, the treasurer is always keeping us in line. You know, he says, okay, guys, but let's stay reasonable in our project. And I have a general secretary. And so we're right now in the midst of rethinking entirely, not the museum itself, because obviously being the birthplace of Escoffier, we're not touching the walls or anything, but all the visiting path along those 10 rooms, and because we've got five floors, it's a village on a hill. So you see, when you come in, you think it's the ground floor, but you have two floors below and two floors above. So we're going to, hopefully, if we get the funding and all this, we're going to completely reorganize the visiting path of the museum. And we want to introduce a lot more of Escoffier's achievements in every one of the steps, and the not just two rooms dedicated to Escoffier, but every room will have something to do with Escoffier at the time when he was doing what he was doing. So we start with the years when he started in Nice and then moved up to Paris. Then he was involved in the Franco-Prussian War, where he started thinking also about the canning food and pre-cooking food so that he could serve the cavalrymen quickly. because they only had about 30 minutes to gulp something down and go back to fight. And then another floor will be dedicated to the period where he meets Brits in Monte Carlo, and together they create what we know today as the palaces of the world, the luxury hotels. Of course, it culminates with the Savoy and then the Ritz in Paris and the Carlton in London. And then when he retires back in Monte Carlo in 1920, he still is very active and actually travels quite a lot in his old age. And the last trip to the United States in 1930 was actually for the opening of the Pierre Hotel in New York. So this is what we want to do, and we want to use a lot more video systems. Like you mentioned the menus, we have something like 3,000 menus. We can't show them physically all in a room, so we have to make a selection. But if we use the video, we can therefore have a lot more menus that will come up, you know, on reels, and we can set them up by classes, like the festive menus or the older menus and the more recent menus, possibly health menus as well, because he was also quite concerned with the balancing of a menu, that he always wanted his clients to leave the table with a light stomach. And the funny thing is, when you read the menus that they were doing those days, although he had simplified things a lot, they still look pretty, you know, heavy to us, but they were not eating large portions of these. They therefore, it was pretty much more like a tasting menu, like the ones we have today, where you can go through 12 or 15 dishes, but you have only one shrimp or one little avocado vinaigrette, you know, things like that.
Yeah, sure.
So this is what we're heading for, and we're just in the midst of setting up the program for that.
It's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. And I so appreciate when I read about, hear about, talk to you about the collaboration, the really unique collaboration that occurred between Escoffier and Ritz so many years ago, which really defined, you know, the world of the hotel and dining in hotels so many years ago. And I parallel that, fast forward 100 years, and here you are again, the Escoffier name, partnering with your good friend, Jack Larson, who happens to be our chairman, president, and CEO. Escoffier and Larson now, 100 years later, redefining education in a very beautiful way, right?
Well, you have to give Jack a lot more credit than to me, because he's the, in that case, he's the visionary. But I understand, you know, what he's aiming at. I fully support it. As I may add, that we've now, with the years since 2010, we've become great friends. I really feel like I'm part of the family. And in fact, the word family comes back to me often, because it's also what I believe is the whole group of students and the teachers. I attended the management reunion a few weeks ago in Texas, with about 100 people who were there. And I was amazed at the passion and the dedication and the friendship that was coming out of these 3 days in San Antonio. But I find the same thing when I visit Austin or the Boulder campus, and I talk to students or I participate in the graduation ceremony. I feel this passion, this enthusiasm, this friendship that goes along, which enables me to say that we're a big family.
So well said. We are a family indeed. Everything that we produce and present to our guests is a reflection of us, right? It's a reflection of our passion, our hard work. I believe that we need to remain true to our traditions, and that's where Escoffier comes in. But just like Escoffier 100 years ago, innovation will come in the form of technology, artificial intelligence. But as long as we remain a family, as long as we remain committed to the fundamental original techniques, I think we're on the right path. I think, like the collaboration between Escoffier and Ritz and the collaboration between Escoffier and Larson, I think the collaboration between Escoffier and AI will be just fine, as long as we remain committed to the tenets that got us here. You know, I would be remiss, Michelle. We've skied together. I know that you enjoy the outdoors and activity, and I know that you're a big, big fan of Formula One racing. I would be remiss if I didn't ask how you felt about, one, where did this love for speed come from? And number two, how are you feeling about this season? I'm still pulling for my British, racer.
since last Sunday, I suggested we don't talk about Formula One anymore. We can talk about the 24 hours of Le Mans.
Okay.
Because I was educated in Italy. I started my school in Italy. I lived there between the age of 6 and 13. And as I said before, my father was actually, those years he was president of Shell in Italy. And Shell was already helping Ferrari financially in the races. So one year he did the major mistake to take me, 56, I was, to take me with him to Maranello for the Mr. Ferrari's press release, you know, conference and all this. And those were the years when, only the older people will understand what I'm saying, that the drivers for Ferrari were people like Fangio, Hawthorn, or Collins. So, I mean, my eyes were popping out. And I was 13 then. And since then, I've been an irrevocable fan of Ferrari, even when we don't win. So at least from last Sunday onwards, we've made our day for the rest of the year. Because imagine that Ferrari came back after 50 years of absence. For the first time, they run into the top class and they win the race, which is one of the three most important races in the world, with the 500 miles of Indianapolis and maybe Monaco. So that was a great relief, at least. But I agree that this year we're going to suffer, because there's a problem with Formula One. It's not just this year. It's been like this since the years of Michael Schumacher and Ferrari. And after that, we had Vettel and Red Bull, and then Hamilton and Mercedes. And now we have Verstappen and Red Bull again. It's the fact is that there are three or four drivers who can all become world champion, and it's only the one that will have the best car that does it. If you put any one of the Charles Leclerc or Lewis Hamilton in a Red Bull, I hope they don't hear that, but only our culinary friends will share this. They would win as well. So it's a bit, there's not enough fight, in other words, because the cars are not at the same level as they were during the 24 Hours of Le Mans, which incidentally was a fascinating race, because an hour and a half before the end, the Ferrari who was in the lead was 10 seconds ahead of the Toyota behind them. So very much until the end, nobody knew who would win the race.
I love your passion for, I'm going to keep watching, but I love your passion. Michelle, the name of our podcast is The Ultimate Dish. I think I know how you're going to answer this, but in your mind, what is the ultimate dish or the ultimate memory of a dish?
The ultimate experience, cooking experience.
There you go.
Culinary experience.
Even better.
Ultimate culinary experience. Well, it's something which I think I've experienced, and I'm probably the only person in the world to have done that. Because as I mentioned before, in 1996, the foundation decided to recreate the Dîner d'Épicure, the Epicurean dinner worldwide. And so we actually, in the end, the result was quite amazing. We had 157 restaurants who served most of them the same day, but sometime it wasn't possible. So they did it the day before or the day after, but they served the same menu in on the five continents in 157 restaurants, and this is without counting the schools. Also, my dear wife Laurence had translated the memories of my life in English, and I was promoting the book with the editor Van Nostrand Reinhold. So I got to New York, and the birthday of Escoffier is 28th of October. So I was in New York about 10 days before that. And my first experience was at the CIA, because I was then a guest of Ferdinand Metz, and I was a speaker at the graduation ceremony at that time. And the students did the dinner, the famous menu that was set up. So they did it in my honor, and that was my first dinner. But then 2 days later, I was in Chicago promoting the book, and I was a guest of Les Dames d'Escoffier in Chicago, who said, oh, incidentally, since you're staying at the Ritz-Carlton, we're testing the dinner that will take place in a week. Would you like to join us? So I joined them, and I had dinner number two, same menu. Then we moved with the young person who was with me from the Nostra Rhinal. We moved to Boston, where we were the guest of Les Dames d'Escoffier in Boston. And they couldn't have the dinner, the Ritz-Carlton, on the same day, on the Monday 28th. So they did it on the Friday before. So that was dinner number three. Then I went back to New York, where I had dinner number four at the Waldorf Astoria with my wife and the 300 guests. That was dinner number four. Then the French Culinary Institute downtown Manhattan called me, and they said, we're having a conference with Jacques Pepin, Julia Child, Anne Willen, and would you like to join us for the conference? I said, yes, I'll be very honored to do that. So we had the conference in the morning, and guess what? At lunch, we had lunch, the menu number five made by the students. And the last one was actually the James Beard Foundation, where Len Piquel, who was the president then, called me and said, are your wife and yourself going to be in New York on the 2nd of November? I said, yes, we're leaving the 3rd. So I said, because we're having a dinner at the James Beard Foundation, and we'd like you to join us. So I said, fine. And this is when actually I met my great friend Mary, because she was married to a captain of TWA, and they were having a holiday once a year. They always go to Wales. In Great Britain. And they were in Wales when Piquel called the day before, and he said, could you be in New York tomorrow? Because we're having Michel Escoffier and his dear wife for lunch, or dinner actually, for dinner at the James Beard Foundation. And Roy, the husband, who was on the phone, tells the story and said, I hadn't even hung up that my wife had already finished her luggage. She had already packed. So Mary was on it. And because he was a pilot, they couldn't get a seat on the plane the next day. They arrived at 3 o'clock in the afternoon local time. And at 6 o'clock, they were at the James Beard Foundation for dinner number six for me. So to conclude, I could say that although I had the same menu six times in about 2 or 2.5 weeks, I never really experienced this. I never had the same experience. In other words, the same ingredients and the same menu was not performed in the same way. And I won't say, because I couldn't, whether there was one best or another. It was just different. So quite amazing, quite a unique experience.
An amazing story, the ultimate Escoffier experience. It's probably close to dinner time. What's for dinner tonight?
Oh, I haven't made up my mind yet. I might actually, you know, very often, quite frankly, I read in my great grandfather's biography his usual menu at the Carlton in the evening, and I often have a menu that is quite close to that, because if I have a larger lunch with people, which we often have at the foundation or with friends and all this, in the evening, I love to have just a soft boiled egg and a soup and a toast, and that will do me fine. But when I'm on my own, I try to do things which are quick, you know, easy to do, and of course, not heavy or anything. No, not heavy sauces or anything like that.
Lovely, lovely. Michel, thank you so much for taking time with us. It's beautiful to see you. We adore you. Thanks for everything that you do for our school. And look forward to seeing you again very, very soon.
Well, I hope so too.
Take care, my friend.
Thank you very much, Kirk. And again, a big hello to all our friends. And the final word is the one that I tell the students. Keep up the good work.
Keep up the good work. Perfect, perfect.
Thank you for listening to the Ultimate Dish Podcast, brought to you by Auguste Escoffier School of Culinary Arts. Visit escoffier.edu/podcast to find any materials mentioned during the podcast, including notes, links, and other resources. And if you can, please leave us a rating on Apple or Spotify and subscribe to support our show. This helps us reach more aspiring individuals ready to take the next step toward their dream careers. Thanks for listening.